You're listening to episode 33 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this interview, we talk with Casey Whalen. Running time for this episode is 38 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
My name's Chad.
My name is Pat.
And joining us today is Casey Whalen.
Hi, everybody.
Now, Casey is a name that may or may not be familiar to you guys. He's not from the tabletop gaming industry, but he is from certainly a niche that overlaps pretty well with ours. And I have no doubt there are people within our audience who are familiar with him, or at the very least familiar with his work. So rather than me setting up anymore, Casey, why don't you give us an idea of who you are, what you've done, what we can blackmail you with?
Well, I'm a 6'2" gentleman from Orange, California. I'm a writer-director. I write a show called We're Alive. It's a serial audio drama, and it's an ongoing podcast. You can get it online for free right now, and it follows a group of survivors in downtown LA. And it's purely audio, so you're only hearing the story like you're listening to a movie, so to speak, but it's tailor-designed specifically for just an audio listening experience. So you're not going to miss something without the visuals. And that's kind of what I do and who I am.
Casey, I'd like to get an idea of how this started. How did you guys take this particular podcast from an idea and bring it to where it is? Because if I'm not mistaken, the way that you guys have it set up, not only does it have a good production quality with sound effects and music and all that kind of stuff, but also you have professional actors that are working in this as the voices. I mean, this is not just like you and a bunch of your beer buddies or whatever. And so I'm curious, how did this go from an idea to being a thing? How did you fund it? How did you get these people involved? What was that process like?
All right, this will take about 3 hours.
Awesome. That's a very content, question. Yes.
Wow, okay. So, well, it's kind of multifaceted because there's the aspect of production and there's also the aspect of the story. I'll kind of try and cover both. The aspect of the production, how that came about was I always had this idea for the zombie apocalypse survival scenario. And that was from overseas. I used to be a soldier and I was deployed to Iraq. And one of the things that they had there was they had a hotel and then they secured the bottom floor. And then every floor above that was then secure because they were able to secure, you know, the bottom and everything was good from on top. So it's like, oh, that's a kind of an interesting scenario for a zombie apocalypse. And so that was kind of the basis for where the story came from. Then kind of built from off from that. And then the other part of it was the production side of it. I used to do animation stuff. It was like my senior thesis in college. And I loved doing audio recording sessions with actors because really you could get anything you wanted from just the audio recording session. But the limitation seemed to always be with the animation. It's always like, oh, we can't seem to emote the right emotion with this character that the person in real life was able to do. So that aspect of it with the actors recording was great for the animation portion. And then I did some sound design stuff for films that were shot without sound, like 16mm films and such. And so I thought, you know, it'd be great to take these two aspects, combine them together, and just create an audio experience because it's all about, like, content. And I could write something that's super long, and it'd be much easier to do with only audio. I could do things that Warner Brothers could match with audio-wise, and I'd be able to do a really high production level at such a small level of money, basically. And so that's kind of like where it stemmed out from, this idea of making a giant mountain out of very little resources and giving a really amazing production.
So I was going to ask at one point how much of your real life experiences played into creating the podcast. But to be honest, after just hearing that, basically the answer is most of the first season.
Yeah, basically most of the everything, to be honest, because every single character is pretty much tied to me in some way in my real life. Many of them are inspirations of real people that were in my unit. Some of them were real people that I know from my life here. My aunt was the inspiration for Kelly. I mean, there's a lot of different characters that just have ties to kind of my experience because I don't think that you can ever just create a character from scratch. You always have to have some sort of inspiration to get an idea of where to start because, you know, just good grounding in reality.
So how did you manage to fund this? I mean, because listening right from the very first episode, this is a very professional product that you've released. I mean, when you listen to a lot of podcasts, you can see the sound quality improve over time. And I'm not saying it doesn't improve in your case, but from the beginning, you guys started sounding like a professional recording.
A lot of that has to do with, fortunately, my job is I work at a university. So I actually manage a soundstage. And one of those perks of working there is I'm able to use it for free. So I was able to actually use that portion of it and have everyone come in, and then the only expenses then are the actors' times And a lot of the post-production I do myself, actually. So as we've grown, we actually have more editors and things like that. But in the beginning, it was just me, the recording studio, and my computer, and just doing a lot of the work myself, just kind of to get it done. And then as we've grown, we've gotten more people to help out. But most of what is the show is just dedication and man hours from the people involved, because most of the people who work on the show don't get paid very much, if anything at all.
Related to that, for a podcast like ours, you know, we know when we want to be done because we pick a topic, we talk about it, and once we've hit that rough hour mark, we're done. When it comes to something like We're Alive, you know, there's kind of really been a set time range that you have for each episode. Has that been kind of a learning process to pace that out, or is this something that, you know, you just kind of instinctively know, or do you tweak it as the process goes along?
Kind of all of the above. It depends on the episode, but we're kind of fortunate because our medium that we've chosen does not have a set end time. So I'm not actually having to write to a time. I feel that actually destroys a lot of writing when you have to fit something into a half hour segment, because you're always going to have like, oh, we have to cut this, or we have to pull this out and extend this. With us, it's pretty much writing the content. Some episodes are 72 pages, some are 90, some are 52. So it all depends on, you know, what the content is. It never seems to go longer than what's been written or what's appropriate. So that's always nice. But most of it's just planned out ahead of time, either through the writing, or sometimes we'd figure out an act break. In the beginning, we didn't actually write it into the script. We kind of figured it out after the recordings were done, and now it's actually written into the scripts. So it was kind of like a learning process of finding out of how long something runs. But typically, like, a chapter's around 60 pages and we divide it into three parts, and those three parts are just kind of where the story has a good break.
So I was kind of curious why you divided it into three parts.
Well, kind of the original model for this was to do an hour-long TV segment, and each one was going to be 12 episodes. 12 hours was one season. Those act breaks were actually, or those episode breaks were really commercial breaks in a way. So that was the idea and the model to go after. So that was the idea, but then it started to be more like, okay, well, we can do this episodic and release one a week, and that way everyone comes back every week and tunes in, because it's all about repeat listenership and repeat impressions. And because if you put out 1 hour-long episode a month, not nearly as effective as 3 20-minute episodes a month. It's like you're constantly having people come back.
In regards to that, your release schedule, now I kind of came along to the show, you were probably about midway through season 2, and of course then I went and backed up and listened from the beginning. But it kind of made me wonder about your release schedule, where you would have those 2-week-long breaks in between each chapter. Were you nervous at the get-go that if you didn't have that consistent weekly kind of release that you might lose listeners or might have some trouble finding traction?
I thought about that, but at the same time, I mean, a lot of TV shows sometimes take an extra week off. We've been pretty consistent with putting out a chapter a month. So we'll do 3 episodes, take a week off, and then put out more, 3 more episodes. So really, the 2-week break is just, we just skip a Monday is all we really do. And yeah, I mean, at times I would think that it would be a little bit nerve-wracking to, and people are like, I really wish you wouldn't skip a week. But at the same time, it's like, that's the week that we spend catching up most things, like, or I spend a lot of time at writing and things like that. Because this is just a part-time gig on top of my 40-hour job. It's definitely not something that would be sustainable without that extra break in there.
You mentioned that this is something that you do on top of your regular 40-hour gig. And I want to go back to the beginning. Like, when you first started this in the first season, how long did it take you to do the first couple episodes that you did, from the pre-production to actually filming it to the post-production? When you started that, what did you find? How long did it take? And what were some of the sort of the pitfalls that you found in doing that?
The average episode, an episode is 20 minutes, a chapter is 60. So an average episode takes about 40 to 60 hours to do completely. That's the editing, writing, all that, everything together. So if you total it up, and I don't want to do the math, it's a lot.
I expected that to be a lot. I never imagined it was that much, though.
Well, and you said that was for an episode, which, and you're saying an episode is one of the 20-minute.
Yeah, a third of a chapter.
Yeah, a third of a chapter, and you're talking 40 to 60 hours worth of work?
Yeah.
Wow.
Gets extremely daunting, because it's like the process starts with writing the chapters. Each chapter is 60 pages long, and it takes a long time just to develop the story and outlines and stuff like that. So by the time I ever get to writing words on the page, I've already spent an enormous amount of time plotting out outlines and doing character sheets and things like that. So I kind of have to calculate that into it as well. But then you have to write 60 pages. They have to be good stuff to move the story forward. Then you have all the redrafting periods of that. And so that's that portion of the writing. And then you have to go in and actually record it with all the actors. That actually doesn't take as long, because we typically will do that all in like one day. We'll do like 2 chapters in a day and just every other month we'll record to try and minimize the amount of the actors' time commitments. Because if you take up too much time, then it's not behooving of the actors to help out. So if you like, if you're annoying and you're like, hey, we have to record this week and then next week and then next week, that would just be very, very difficult. But every other month, it's not so bad. So the actors record six times a season. Yeah, it's not too bad.
With that much editing time, how much do you have to have done before you start a season? Yeah, like, do you do all the recording before you start a season? Do you have a couple episodes ready to go before you drop the first one of a season? Just how much lead time do you give yourself?
To be honest, we give ourselves about 5 days lead time for the episode. So we're working about a week ahead, and it's good and bad. The aspect of like having that rigid a production schedule is kind of similar to what I would think South Park does. It kind of forces you to get it done and push as hard as you can. If I was working a week ahead, I might be a little bit more lax. So we tend to work pretty much like the week of kind of thing, which is not great. But then again, it's what we can do with our schedule. I will say that the start of this next season, we're actually working about two or three episodes ahead just because the season starts and then I get married like the next week. So yeah, that was a little chaotic.
So let me create some context here for anyone in our audience that's not familiar with your work. When did you guys release your first episode?
May 5th, 2009, I think.
So May 5th, 2009. So your audio is what, about 4 years old now? How many episodes have you released in 4 years?
105, I believe.
Okay. Now, here's one of the things that strikes me as interesting. Now, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but you are not crowdfunded. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have some sponsors. We sell merchandise on our website. We have a couple AdSense things from Google, and the rest I fill in with my own funds.
So let me ask you about that, because where we sit right now and kind of in the context of the history of new media, young as that history is, and I'm not saying this by any stretch of the imagination to bash on crowdfunding, because I think crowdfunding is a great option that has allowed a lot of wonderful things to happen. But that is not the route that you went. And I'm curious, was that a struggle to get things started? And has there been the temptation to go back and attempt to crowdfund some portion of this? Or given the fact that you have managed to establish yourself as a success, is that just really something that you don't see as necessary?
Yeah, that's kind of why I haven't gone to Kickstarter. Well, it didn't really exist when we first started out. I don't think it was really big in 2009. It's huge now. But also, I didn't think it was necessary for the story. Like, we didn't really need the money, if that makes sense. Like, our micro budgets and the way that we do our finances are so small and minute that we were able to manage at the level we are. And if we needed to put more money into it, I just would kick up a couple more myself. The thing with crowdsourcing is it's almost more work for us in the end, because say, for instance, I did Kickstarter with We're Alive, I'd have to give people stuff. And then it starts to become like a chore, like, oh, now I have to send out all these things. Now I have to track all of them. And it's just really a burden on the production when there's so many other things that have to be focused on. And that was something that I didn't want to have to deal with. It doesn't seem worth it to me in some ways. I mean, if we wanted to make something big, yes. But I, at this level, at this time, it just seemed like, okay, we'll let it pass. We won't really go that route. We'll create our stuff, and then we'll have options for people if they want to buy t-shirts and stuff. That's how they can continually help the show. And if they want to donate, they can donate. But I just didn't want to get on the hook for that sort of thing.
What I found fascinating is that I know you guys, after a season's done, you release it on CD out on Amazon. And I find it fascinating that so many people will go out and buy it after having listened to the free version. Because I know you, the last season sold out. What was it, within a day of being put up?
That's one of the things that I love about our listeners and our fans is they understand the process that we go through. And to be honest, we offer them a little bit better package with the remasters, because the remasters, basically each chapter becomes just one chunk. There's no breaks in between the episodes. And we also go back and polish out the audio, make it all even. And it's just, it's a lot more easily accessible for the listeners. So that's kind of the reason why we do it. Because right now, all of our episodes are on podcast form on the server. Eventually, who knows, maybe we will shut down the server and not have the free podcast version. That's not in the plans, foreseeable future. But the fans like to have those collector things. And I'll be honest, the fans who actually purchased the first season of ours, we actually had a first printing that we self-published. We only did 500 of them. We sold out years ago. And that first season now can still go for $500 or $1,000 on eBay.
Wow.
First printing. It's kind of cool because the way that we do things is we never make the same printing twice. The CD sets that we have now, they're all, you know, different printings of that. like each version of t-shirts we only do once and then we never do it again. So we kind of like the idea of making collector's things at the same time.
One of the aspects of your show that I want to talk about is the zombies themselves. Because right now, if you look within geek subculture, zombies is a theme that really is saturating the culture right now. You know, between World War Z and Warm Bodies and Walking Dead, and it, just everywhere you turn, there's zombie stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that. You said, oh, yeah. So
well, was zombies a thing in 2009?
No, like, it wasn't. Yeah. Like, it wasn't very big. the original business model for We're Alive was, okay, produce this in podcast form, pitch it as a TV show, get picked up, and we have a Survivor series. And then The Walking Dead stepped in, like, as we were wrapping up, I think, midway of season one. And it just kind of killed us in a way. We've stuck to the medium, and I think ours is a different story. But, yeah, the market's been so overly saturated with it that it's depressing in a way. I mean, I'm still telling a story. I have another one to tell after this that's not zombies, thankfully. But I'm not a big zombie fan. So it's one of those things where everyone thinks that, oh, yeah, you write over zombie stories. You must love and watch all of them. It's like, no, not really. It's just something.
You had a story to tell, and it wasn't really a thing in 2009. And well, it just kind of.
And I've said frequently, some of the best zombie stories, the zombies are the setting.
Yeah.
They allow you to do what you want to do with story.
It's an apocalypse survivor story. And you have to have a mechanism on why the apocalypse happened or why the survivors are there. And zombies, or a plague, or a bomb, or whatever. A meteor could be anything.
Except I've noticed with the story, it's not just generic zombies. There are different types of zombies. Have you ever played the video game Left 4 Dead?
I did many, many years ago, and somebody told me that there are some ones in like Left 4 Dead 2 that they actually like have some similarities with our story.
Oh yeah, a lot of similarities. That's why I was wondering if that had been an influence or if you'd created those before.
It wasn't intentional. There's a couple things that are, for our specific zombies, so to speak, that are anything you think of a human enhancement, like a smarter person, a smarter zombie, a faster person, a faster zombie, those types of things. A bigger person, a bigger zombie. So they're just multipliers of certain aspects of what we have as qualities. I can see how there's a lot of crossovers between there. It's just ways of improving base structure, if that makes sense.
So you describe yourself as not, per se, being a fan of zombies. When I started this podcast, I waited out there and decided, okay, I'm going to take my time, my money, the resources of some of my friends, and we're going to put this out here. We had to be a fan of it, I think, in a certain way, in order to keep it going. But the question I have for you is not, per se, to defend your choice to do what you did by a stretch of the imagination. But I'm just curious, if you're not a fan of zombies, then what is it about zombies that drew you to them? You know, when you waited out there to tell a story, why not pick something you were a fan of? What is it about zombies that made you want to tell that story and not some other story?
When I say I'm not a fan of zombies, I think I'm more of not a fan of the zombie that is out there right now. The flesh gore, bones dripping with blood, so to speak. I'm not a fan of that. And the reason why is because I'm pretty much a man of science. And I see someone's like a zombie that's missing giant chunks of their muscle structures being able to walk on their legs. And that drives me nuts. It's just I don't see a rhyme or reason to it. And I think a lot of the zombie stuff that I'm not a fan of is very gore related, very violent, instead of something that is more suspense driven. So that's where I'm not a big fan of. But I like, say, for instance, 28 Days Later, I enjoyed that version of it. And also, I like the aspect of the humanity of it, because to take another person's life that is a human is a huge thing. And when they're attacking you and become zombies, it's a lot more of a dramatic choice to have to, kill another human being. And it's the only time in modern media that's acceptable, and we kind of get to play on those tropes a little bit.
Yeah, I think yours is the only of the many, many, many zombie audio fictions I've listened to that actually has dealt with someone shooting a person for the first time and dealing with the mental trauma of that happening. I don't think I've ever experienced that with another zombie-related audio fiction.
Well, thank you. That's exactly that's kind of what I want, because a lot of people think it's easy to pull a trigger when, in fact, it's not at all.
You know, and actually, Wayne kind of brings up a good point. I want to go back around to talk a little bit about, in regards to the cast, for being the effort that it is, yeah, you have gotten some very solid, strong voice actors. And having watched them in the live readings that you've done, I've been pretty impressed with their ability to make it through a full reading like that and really not have issues. So I'm going to give you kind of a two-part question. How were you able to find folks like that who are able to, you know, commit consistently in that regard? And then how did you really manage such a large cast in the show? I mean, I know that you have the limited recording times, but that's a lot of people to manage and to try and schedule.
It's definitely not easy. Like, I think our total number of people we've had on the show is 88. So it's by no stretch of the imagination an easy feat. I mean, we have juggled many recording sessions at separate times. We've actually had to record people separately. Like, one of our actors lives in Louisiana now, so we have to record them in a different soundstage remotely. It's very difficult to juggle all that. And it's progressively gets more and more difficult to juggle that many as the seasons progress, because people move on with their lives and they may have started somewhere, but they go somewhere else. So we've had a couple of people move away. We've had to make some adaptations and things like that. But it's worked, because it's been a lot of luck. Saul had to go for extended vacation, and well, I had him get attacked and he was sick. So it worked out okay, where we can put him off the side for a little bit and kind of just explore this aspect. And so it's a lot of kind of adaptive writing to make that work.
I was wondering about how many character death were because people had to move away, or there is a lot of a character will be missing for a while. I was wondering if that was schedule related.
It depends on the person, depends on the part of the story. A lot of the times, especially with audio dramas, you can't put too many characters in one episode. Otherwise, it can get a little confusing for somebody who's just picking it up again. So I try and keep my scenes smaller. Sometimes they just get big without any control. But that's one of the things where it's like, I'll try and hone in on a small scene at a time rather than big scenes with lots of people, because that gets confusing just in the medium.
As a gamer, I find myself listening, and I don't know, are you an RPG player at all?
Yes. Depends on the RPG you're speaking of, though.
Okay. We're mostly tabletop RPGs.
I played a little bit. I haven't really got any good dungeon masters, so to speak. I played a couple times with my brothers, but all the time, the oldest brother who would take charge of things just made up everything on the fly in a very poor way. So he would make up stuff as he went, and it drove me nuts. It's like, there's something over here, and you have to, like, do my laundry in order to get past it.
That is awesome.
Actually, it sounds like in a Mark Twain-ish sort of way. I think he had it down pretty solid.
Yeah.
I was young at the time, and I was like, sure, yeah, that's fine.
I find myself frequently listening, though, and it's like, the party keeps splitting. Stop splitting the party. You listen to their reactions and things do.
I think you need to take some of these lessons and apply them. You need to call up somebody who's not moving away, you know, who really wants the exposure, and be like, hey, you know, I'm thinking about killing you off. My lawn needs mowing. What you do with these facts are completely up to you. I'm just putting it out there.
To be honest, though, like with people moving away, we're talking minuscule differences. Like the main character is the one that I was speaking of is in Louisiana, Michael, and no one has noticed. So it's one of those things where it's like, it's not completely out of the ordinary. But I will say, back to the other question that I didn't get the answer before, was how do we find these people? A lot of it was a lot of luck that first day in the casting session, finding the right people who just fit perfectly in those spots. And then also taking those people who we found and then going back to the script and making some changes to better suit and fit the role a little bit, and then kind of tweaking it along the way. Because you're never going to find anybody perfect, but sometimes what they bring is some things you've never seen before. So there's always that.
I think one advantage that you've got in this kind of story is actually a little joke I've heard that kind of fits into this. You know why George R.R. Martin doesn't have a Twitter account?
I don't know why.
He can't get through 140 characters without killing them. With a zombie story, you have a great pliability because of the fact that you've got this band of survivors. They can encounter new people under any number of circumstances. Obviously, the existing people are existing on the brink of death. I mean, that's the tension of the story. And so removing people, adding people, whatever, you have a lot of plausible room to do that within the context of the story.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
It's not like you're telling a story about people that are stranded out in deep space where somebody coming along would really be a major event, or somebody dying would be conceivably very unexpected. And so you've got a lot of room there to maneuver in terms of who's actually on the show.
Yeah, that's one of the nice things is I can also play with the timeline a little bit. There's been times where I've had a character who wasn't available for a certain recording session, and we can just record them a different day, or I can actually even push those scenes off and move it to a different section. So I think if we were a bigger production, it'd be harder. You know, especially if you're shooting something on film, you have to have two people in the scene at the same time, no working around it. Whereas us, it's like, well, I guess we can do a makeup session for you on this day. If I guess we'll just have someone read with this person and then put them together. It's more stress on me as a director that way, because I have to really know how the scene flows and the characters' reactions and things. But it's not as bad. It's something I pretty much have gotten used to over the years.
So you're getting ready to go into your final season here. How much of the story was plotted out from the beginning versus going along? Did you always know you were going to do four seasons?
Yes. Well, here's the thing is I knew the story. I didn't know how long it would take me to tell that story. So that's why when season three was around mid-season three, I was like, well, I have the story, but I don't know if it's going to be three or four seasons. I debated that for a long time. And then I got to a point where I was like, I can't fit this in one season. This has to go for one more. And I literally plotted out the first two seasons in one evening. I just sat in my bed one night with my computer and just went bam and just knocked it all out. And then about midway through season one, I figured out the ending. The only season that was a little bit skeptical at that point was season three. And season three was figured out in part of season two. So season four was actually figured out a lot more in advance than season three. Season three was the one that was a little bit more discovered kind of midway through the experience. But there's big points I had to make and big events that I had to get to. And as long as I had those marks, it was pretty easy to figure out along the way.
Yeah, a couple months back, I was listening to a friend of mine who's another host on the show. He's not on this particular episode. But I was listening to him deconstruct what he thought was at least some part of the appeal of a zombie story. And the way he described it to me, and it took me a minute to process this, but I think he was on to something, is he said that zombie stories appeal to many people because of the fact that they are fundamentally misanthropic. If you look at a zombie story, you have people who, of course, everyone really projects themselves into those shoes. We are the selected few that has survived a terrible event because, whether we phrase it this way or not, some part of course, believes that we deserve to survive it. You know, everybody's the hero of their own story. And what you have around you are these masses of people pantomiming what looks like a human life. And yet these people are really just mindless drones to be disposed of as they get in your way or attempt to predate upon your life. And what he kind of put forth was that while many zombie fans may not be willing to admit it, and I certainly would not stereotype so far as to say this is true of all zombie fans, but what he posits is that to at least a good percentage of them, or some percentage of them, that perhaps there's kind of a subconscious appeal to these stories because it expresses these frustrations that many of us have with sort of the banality of life. But one of the things that sounds fascinating about the story that you're putting together and have been putting together is the fact that it goes really, in many ways, a very different direction from that. You talked about, for example, that in killing a zombie, it's not an easy choice. It's not disposing simply of a predator, but it's very much facing the idea that you are killing another human being, even if their state is, shall we say, less than positive. And I'm curious how that's affected your storytelling. And was this something that you set out to do, to try and create a different kind of dynamic there? Was that really just more of a side effect of your own life experiences and the story you were trying to tell?
I think it's multifaceted, because in a lot of ways, I actually don't like violence. And a lot of people find that surprising when I'm writing a story like this. There's actually stuff in a story that physically disgusts me, and that's why it's in there. In a way, like some of the torture scenes I loathe and I hate, but it's part of the storytelling. But it's also the character aspect of Pegs, where it's like she was the kind of the consciousness of these are still people, even when they were being attacked, because there's other antagonists in the story besides the zombies. She still saw them as people and others that are just struggling to survive as well. So it's just kind of barbaric to pull a trigger. And that aspect actually is maintained in the story of because she kills somebody and it lives with her for a very, very long portion, even though it was out of self-defense. So that comes into it a lot. And I think the other thing that you're pointing out of why people like the zombie stories so much is my theory is a little bit different of why. It's because it becomes, and you alluded to this a little bit, is the simplification of our lives. We're basically right now in the world, we're daunted by technicalities and paperwork And in this world, it's basically you directly get out of the world what you put into it. It's kind of like we've gone back to the caveman aspect where your cave may be safe, but you have to have a big old club when you go out. Otherwise, you could get attacked by something, so to speak. And you have to gather food in order to keep your family surviving, that kind of thing. So you directly correlate with your own survival. So it's kind of a little mix of both.
One small bit of fan gush in regards to those torture scenes. Those actually were probably some of the most dramatic and compelling scenes. And it, just as a listener, I will usually try and listen to each part of each chapter twice. But you know, one of those scenes in particular I had to listen to actually multiple times because I was impressed in the way in which it was handled, not only in the way it necessarily was written, but it brought out the true aspects of a couple of the characters, specifically Scratch and Bert is the one scene I'm thinking of. But
I had a feeling that's what you were going with, Chris.
Yeah, that one was probably the most telling scene for me, at least for the third season. It was very well done. But one of the things that Dan had mentioned earlier, talking about zombie fans, kind of leads into where I want to talk a little bit about your audience. I mean, obviously, you're very successful, and no doubt you've attracted a lot of people who are fans of that genre. But have you found in your interactions with your fans that you've have a broader appeal and are attracting people from other demographics or certain genres?
I'm kind of blown away. I receive messages all the time and all over our social media walls from people who are like, you know what? I didn't really like zombies, but I love this story. Or I don't like scary things, but I love, there's something in there for everybody. And I think a lot of our female listeners, I'm blown away by the amount of female listeners we have.
Why do you think that is?
Well, some people say that some of the characters, the female characters are weak, but I have to say that we probably have some of the strongest female characters out there. I mean, in some ways, the male characters have almost been weaker. Some of the female characters in the story are far stronger, in my opinion anyway, and they make better, more sound judgments and opinions. Like, I think Pegs is more courageous in a lot of ways than some of the other characters because she holds true to her values even in the hardest of times. And there's other characters like, it won't spoil too much, but CJ is, I think, a better leader than somebody who's been in the military for years. It's just, and she was a civilian. So I think there's a lot of female characters that just have good draw and pull of people sympathizing. But there's always those other female and male characters that people hate as well. I think one aspect of why there's so many people like different characters is there's somebody for everybody.
Plus, there's a lot of romance in there as well. So I think that hits across other genres too.
Yeah, I think that's another thing is there are multiple different types of love stories in there. There's one that is completely off the wall. They don't even know what their relationship is. And it's very weird. Another one where it's just pure unadulterated love for each other, like through thick and thin. And there's other ones where they're just casual flings that are barely even mentioned. And there's other ones that may or may not be heterosexual. So it's like there's a little bit of mix of everything in there that I think is pretty true to real life.
Going back to what you're saying about interactions with your fans, so you have found people who just from basically all walks who've kind of found this. I mean, are these people who get into, you know, audiobooks, or is it something that this is, do you feel it's some sort of like callback to the old radio drama type days? Or, you know, what are you finding?
To be honest, I'm not sure what each person's experience is just because I haven't had that much experience with them. But a couple I can recall is I don't even know what a podcast was until I tried this and I absolutely love it. There's some people who were just looking for stuff on iTunes, music, or, you know, just the audiobook section and found us that way or something through Audible. And it's nice to see the people who are just like experiencing something like that for the first time. And there's other people who just like talk show podcasts who like, hey, I'll try something different. Oh, this is cool. This is something unique. Weirdly enough, I haven't found a lot of fans of the show that are big-time old radio drama fans. It seems like we're picking up a lot more people who have never heard of an audio drama or even an audio production.
I think also in this day and age, I'm not by any stretch of the imagination saying it's impossible, but I think it gets a bit harder to really have a grounding in the radio dramas. I mean, if we're to be honest, probably everyone listening to the show did not grow up with radio dramas, or if they did, they were on the tail end of these kinds of things.
I listened to them all by buying them on CD.
Yeah, I mean, I've listened to a couple, like I've listened to, for example, the War of the Worlds one, but I had that on a cassette tape. It's not like I flipped on my radio and heard it on there. And so I think what podcasting has allowed is kind of a rediscovery of that genre. But I don't think it's really quite honest to say that it's truly a nostalgia because of the fact that I think you're going to see that a bulk of listeners to podcasts aren't old enough to be blunt to have. And I'm not saying I'm not saying there aren't any. I have no doubt there are people who did spend some portion of their life listening to radio dramas, or even if they're younger or whatnot, or maybe just hobbyists that are enthused by that kind of thing. But I think really what would draw people to something like that is not per se a nostalgia for radio drama so much as just the same thing that draws people to RPGs. The human passion for storytelling. We want to hear and consume stories, particularly when we're able to connect with them on some level.
I think the only connection is mostly through audiobooks is what people are used to, because I know a lot of people who found us through audiobooks. That's the limited exposure I think that people have had nowadays.
So Casey, as we wrap this up, there's two things that I want to make sure we get from you. First off, just in case nobody has caught it through the course of this episode, and as always, I will put it in the show notes. So if you're in your car, you can catch this when you get to work or wherever it is and look this up. What is the website where people can find this material?
It's on zombiepodcast.com. Pretty easy to remember. And there's a little listen tab where you can get it and download it on iTunes, your phone, Stitcher. You can stream it on the website live. We make everything pretty easy and available.
I bet there are hundreds of people out there that hate you for beating them to that address.
I didn't have it at first. The show started out at thezombiepodcast.com, and somebody let their domain lapse, and I just was first in line.
Whoopsie. You know, actually, I came pretty close to getting battletech.com before somebody grabbed it, if you can believe that one. But yeah, okay, I guess also beats being zombiepodcast.angelfire.com or something like that. So the other thing I want to make sure we get from you, is there anything else out there you've got going on right now? Is there anything coming up that you want to draw people's attention to? Is there anything beyond the zombie podcast that you want to sort of tease out there for people to be looking at?
To be honest, pretty much I'm solely focused on We're Alive right now. There's a We're Alive book. It's a little short novella we've been working on for a while that won't come out till a little bit after season four, it looks like, just because of delays in writing. So that will come out eventually. And then there's another story after We're Alive. But mostly it's just We're Alive right now. Season four comes up and starts. Actually, I can release it with you guys because we're going to make the announcement tomorrow morning. It's our new season starts up August 26th, I believe, which is the last Monday in August. Yeah, 26th.
Well, Casey, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's been great having you on. I hope you guys listening at home will go and check this podcast out, try out some audio drama if you've not before. And if you have, then give this story a little bit of time in your circulation. And as for you guys at home, as always, have a great week and great games. And we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.